I'm David Crow. Thank you for listening in to episode 93 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us or join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. You can listen to us live at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, or after the live broadcast, download us on iTunes or other podcast programs. Remember, I don't know your listener till I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, possibly with some comments, suggestions for future guests, and most importantly, if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. Andre wrote to me on email, "I just listened to your latest podcast on dirty electricity. In my view, Sam was not able to provide a strong argument that the correlation he saw with electricity and illness was also causation. I could tell throughout the interview you were pushing to get more evidence that it wasn't purely correlative." And he's right about that. "For instance, I've done quite a bit of looking at nutrition, and it seems that you have too. Dropping the carbohydrates seems to drop insulin production, and thus people become thinner. You would be interested in NUSI.org, N-U-S-I.org, and their goal of determining what is healthy nutrition for humans for the cost of just one drug, less than $1 billion. It turns out to be quite expensive to run highly rigorous nutrition trials." And if I can make a comment here, there are very few clinical trials of anything that are run when there's not a potentially big profitable payoff. So trials that could result in people using less drugs are unlikely to be funded. They might be funded by a government or an institution, but in general it's trials that perhaps are developing some new nutritional supplement or a new pill that will get funded. Andre continues, "Still, there may be something to what he was saying. I give these guys lots of room to generate hypotheses because often enough they're onto something. It seems that human history is one big story of discovering that what we thought was benign was actually harmful. Given that, you may want to check out my friend's recent TEDx talk, which is entitled Wireless Wake-Up Call, and I'm going to share your interview with him as well. I think you're likely right about the general avoidance of examining toxicology before rushing to viral causes. I don't go all the way to where Jim West is, but I'm pretty close. Also, I did listen to Alan Cassell's. I might reach out to him for my project, vaccinecourse.org. Thank you, Andre, for your feedback. I think you touched on about four different recent shows. Jim West, that's two shows. Alan Cassell's, the electricity show, that's quite a bit. I really do appreciate hearing from people who are listening and who agree with me on some things and don't agree on others. Maybe we will cover this issue of electricity, wireless communications again in the future, despite my conflict of interest, which I addressed in the show. Now let's go to today's guest, who's going to talk about one of my favorite topics, side effects of drugs. Bob Fideman is an Englishman who experienced the hell of Paxil, although he would call it Sarosact, and after he got off it, he didn't quit. He'll tell us about his experience and a pending class action lawsuit against the manufacturer, GlaxoSmithKline. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thanks for having me, David.
So,
By the way, it's pronounced Seroxat.
Seroxat.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm always bad with where the stress goes in words.
Well, we can call it Paxil for the benefit of the listeners.
Yeah, probably most. I have listeners all over the world, but probably the majority are Americans. So we'll call it Paxil, but Seroxat, if that slips out, everybody knows that it's really the same thing.
Yeah, for sure.
So why were you put on Paxil in the first place?
Well, it was work related issues. I was having difficulty at work with the people I was employed with at the time, and I went to see my doctor. I was kind of down in the mouth about it all, you know. Mm-hmm. And he prescribed me Paxil, you know, because it was a drug at the time that would help lift the blues, you know. But, you know, I obviously at the time would accept anything, because when you're in that situation, you know, you've got money worries and work worries, you will accept anything that is deemed to help you. But of course, you know, since then, I know a lot more about it, and I wouldn't recommend anybody take Paxil at all.
Well, yeah, like getting to the subject of depression, I mean, you mentioned work worries. It seems to me that people go to the doctor because they're depressed about their job, their relationship, money, innumerable things, often a combination of those things, right? They're just divorced, they're short of money, they have a horrible work environment, or they just got laid off, and their world's collapsing, and they go to the doctor, and it's called depression.
Yep.
I mean, did you buy into that medical model of sadness in those days?
Well, at the time, obviously, most people then and even now go to see their doctor because of circumstantial stuff going on in their life. It is given the label depression. And we kind of buy into that because, yes, we are feeling down, so it must be depression. I don't actually believe it is depression. It's just circumstances, you know, that you're having to go through. And the idea of a tablet or a pill fixing all these problems is just nonsense, you know?
Well, you can go to church for that too, right? Like you can go get communion, and that little piece of bread is also going to fix all your problems.
If you're that way inclined, you know, if you believe in God and Jesus and all the rest of it, yeah, for sure you can, you know, you can get comfort by praying or whatever.
But, and that's actually true. And I think, you know, the power of a pill is if you truly believe in it, it at least in the short term will have some benefits, just like going to church has a lot of benefits for people who truly believe. But communion wafers don't have the side effects that Paxil has. So maybe you can tell us, like, what did you experience once you got on Paxil?
Well, when I first started taking Paxil, it seemed to make me not care about anything. So all the problems that I did have, I had work problems, money problems, and as a knock-on effect, marriage problems came into that.
Right.
But I didn't care. I just really did not give a stuff about anything. So it kind of blunts your emotions. You know, you feel no empathy when you're on these drugs, which was totally different to how I normally felt when I was on the drugs. You know, I'd sort of like cry at the drop of a hat if I saw a beautiful painting or listened to the lyrics of a beautiful song. You know, I'd shed a tear.
Right.
When you're on this stuff, it just completely blocks all of that, and you don't care about anything. So your whole world is crumbling around you, your marriage and your finances. But you really don't care. But that is the job of antidepressants. That's what they're supposed to do.
I mean, if you don't care, then probably your relationships, your financial situation, your job are only going to get worse. I mean, do you think things actually got worse for you because you were on Paxil, or was it already bad enough that it didn't make much difference?
Well, you know, I mean, things was bad on the work front at the time. My relationship, you know, it was, I'd been married about, what, 6-7 years, and it was fine up until that point. But of course, I was off work for an unrelated illness. I developed osteoarthritis in my hips, and the company that I worked for, which was a car manufacturer, told me that they couldn't find me any light duties. And if I wanted to return to work, I must go back on the production line, which I couldn't physically do because it was causing me pain. And that kicked off a whole debate of whether or not they was being fair to me.
Right.
And my doctor said, if you do go back on the track, your condition is just going to get worse. Right. So taking this Paxil, you kind of don't care. You just do not care what's going on around you. And you think it will sort itself out, you know? Right. When obviously what you need to do when you're in this predicament is get to the root cause of it and try and sort it out, you know?
Yeah, like maybe get a, you know, instead of waiting for the company to come up with some light-duty job that might be intensely boring, like find some other employment that's more rewarding and less physically damaging to your body.
Yeah. I mean, you've got all of that, of course. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated in that with the actual company that I worked for, I couldn't just leave because I would have lost a load of, you know, benefits and pension and all the rest of it. But like I say, when I first went on it, it kind of blunted me and it felt different. And I think that's the key there. When you do feel depressed, and I say that, you know, waving my fingers in the air, but when you are diagnosed with depression and you take something for it and then your brain starts to feel different, then this thing that you're taking must be working, right? It must be.
I mean, I guess you were less depressed because you just didn't give a rat's ass about anything. Were there worse side effects than just not really caring that you experienced?
Oh, yeah. Well, the side effects. I mean, the first time I experienced, I don't know whether you've ever heard of the electric zaps.
No.
What happens when you miss a dose of Paxil and many other antidepressants in the SSRI family is that you get these, it's almost like your brain is being fried. It's like an electric zap. It's like being poked with a prod, you know, with electric running through it. And your whole body just shakes. So if you're holding a hot drink, a cup of tea, as us Brits like to drink, your body will shake and the tea will actually jerk in your hand. You know, and it could be very dangerous if you're holding tea and you're maybe holding a small child
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you start getting, we call them the zaps, you know, for short. And I first experienced them when I went on holiday with my family. And what I did stupidly, because there was nothing on the packaging, on the labeling, I was thinking, I'm going on holiday. I don't need these tablets.
Right.
So we traveled, you know, about 3 hours down to the south coast of England. And within 24 hours, I was getting these horrendous zaps. And my then wife, I mean, we're divorced now, but she said to me, have you brought your Paxil with you? And I said, oh, no, I didn't think I'd need it because I'm on holiday. And she got in touch with my family doctor, who then faxed a prescription through to the place where we were staying, so I was able to pick it up and go to a local pharmacy.
So to deal with the withdrawal symptoms, you went back on it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, of course, at the time, you don't think it's withdrawal. You think it's your depression returning, you know?
Right.
And that's the problem that a lot of doctors have. When people actually say, look, doc, I think I'm okay now. I want to come off this drug. And they can come off too fast. And the side effects actually mimic depression. So you'll get bouts of sadness and you'll get teary and all the rest of it. And they will go back to their doctor and the doctor will put them back on the drug because he thinks it's the depression returning. When in actual fact, it's a side effect of the drug.
And they actually do this when they're testing the drugs, that what they do if they want to test an antidepressant is they'll have people, say, on another antidepressant, and they're going to divide people into two groups. So you've got the antidepressant they're testing, and mm-hmm. then you've got placebo. So they have this so-called washout period, and then you now have people who are in full-bore withdrawal symptoms compared with people who've just changed from one SSRI to another,
uh-huh.
who are obviously doing better, and the withdrawal symptoms become the symptoms of your disease, and therefore
absolutely.
The drug works.
Yeah.
You know,
Well, you know, I mean, if the drug actually worked, there wouldn't be so many people self-harming or committing suicide whilst on the drugs,
yeah.
You know. And also, with GlaxoSmithKline, they have never carried out any withdrawal studies whatsoever with Paxil, and yet they have been warned many times in various clinical trials. I mean, I pulled one up a few months ago. I found a clinical trial online. It was actually internal email to GSK, where they was trying Paxil with another drug, and it showed that the people on the Paxil was having bad withdrawal on it. And instead of investigating that, they actually pulled the study, because if they, you know, if they would have investigated it, they would have found, oh my God, there's quite a lot of people that this can happen to. Therefore, you know, they would have had to kind of admit, yes, our drug can cause serious withdrawal. And they don't even admit that today, despite settling over 3,500 cases in America.
Yes. Well, they definitely manipulate clinical trials. I mean, they kind of, a clinical trial is like a coin toss, right? And they want them all to come up heads. So since they don't all come up heads, all the ones that come up tails, they just shuffle them aside. And then they show you, look, I just flipped a bunch of heads, so this drug must be, this must be great.
Yeah, they cherry pick. Cherry pick the results for sure.
You also mentioned rage. Like how bad did this get with you?
Well, if I ever missed a dose, I would get really, really agitated. And one thing that I found, which is a side effect of Paxil, but it's quite rare. You know, it's not many people get it. And that was my intolerance to sudden loud noises. So you can imagine I had three young children at the time.
Right.
So if I ever missed a dose and they're there playing, and as kids do, they're loud and they'll clap their hands at, you know, at certain times, right, I would literally jump out of my skin and my head would boil. My head would absolutely boil. So it was an intolerance to sudden loud noises. With the rage, that came more when I decided to go cold turkey on Paxil. Now, I'm jumping the gun a little bit here. I'm not sort of like giving you the whole story.
Yeah, I mean, I want to get to the whole withdrawal thing. But like, as time went on, you decided you wanted to get off. Like, what did you learn that made you decide that this wasn't working for you?
Well, I just thought that I'm better now. I must be better now. You know, I've been on this drug for 4 years.
Right.
What is the point of me continuing to take it? So I think initially I told my doctor, who was brilliant. My doctor was absolutely brilliant. You know, I do not blame my doctor for prescribing me Paxil, because he, like the general public, was completely duped by the whole marketing thing. So I don't blame him at all. So anyway, I think I first started withdrawing from it, and I can't remember what the, because it was such a long time ago, I can't remember what he told me to come down by, but whatever it was too much of a drastic drop. So we decided to come down a little bit slower than what was first recommended. And even that wouldn't help. So it's like cutting a tablet in half. And because I was on 40 milligrams, so maybe taking 30 milligrams at first, and then drop to 20, et cetera, et cetera, which is actually what GlaxoSmithKline recommend on the patient's information leaflet. And they also say that you may experience some withdrawal symptoms. These will last generally 2 weeks. Well, it took me 19 months to taper down from 40 milligrams per day to 22 milligrams a day, and that's when I just decided enough's enough. I can't do this anymore. I'm just going to go cold turkey. And it was against everything that I'd read about it, about Paxil, you know, do not go cold turkey. But I thought, well, I can handle it at this point now. You know, we're talking a couple of years on from my marriage. I moved out of the marital home and was living alone in a small little council place. You know, council place is like social housing over there. And I thought, well, I live alone. I can do this. So basically, I was on the liquid Ciroxat at the time, where you have to inject liquid into your mouth using an oral syringe. There's no needle. It's just a slower way to come down. It's actually a good way to taper.
Right. I was going to say, actually, with some drugs, which are kind of like coated, you can't actually cut them. So, I mean, a liquid is the perfect way. If you got to have a choice of a way to get off a drug, it's kind of the best.
And unfortunately, Paxil is one of those SSRIs that has got a liquid. There are some of the SSRIs that don't have that option. I think Cymbalta, because it's full of beads, the capsules of Cymbalta, right. I don't believe that they've got a liquid. So people withdrawing from Cymbalta, they actually break open the capsule and remove the beads inside to taper down. It's a ridiculous way of coming off a drug, but it's the only way that they can do it. With me, I was on the liquid. Anyway, I decided to throw the bottles of liquid out and thought, okay, batten down the hatches. This is it. You're in for a rough ride. I just didn't know how rough it was. You know, within 24 hours, I'm curled up in the fetal position. I've got terrible sweats. My head is pounding. I've got the zaps ripping through me. I'm angry. I'm crying. So angry and sad. It's like all your emotions just come back in one go.
Right.
I'm punching holes in walls in my flat. I'm going out at night in the middle of the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, in the freezing cold weather, seeking confrontation in a country park that I would never ever walk. I wouldn't even walk through that country park now with two bouncers next to me, two doormen. It is pretty scary. And there I was going through withdrawal, walking through that country park on my own. And it was like this voice in my head saying, you know, if anybody approaches me, just fight them. Just fight. Right. I had so much anger in me, you know, and I honestly didn't know at the time where this anger was coming from. But since then, I've heard so many stories, pretty much the same, where people just feel angry when they're coming off this drug. It's definitely down to Paxil.
And how long did it take you before you got past that?
3 months. I basically, I remember one night my children came over, all three of them, with my nephew, and they was playing on a PlayStation game or, you know, Xbox or something like that. And they were pretty boisterous. And I said to them, look, can you be quiet? And I explained to them the reasons why, because any noise was kind of magnified by 10 times, you know, in my head. And, of course, kids being kids, they totally ignored me. And I remember them, they were playing a football game on the computer, and they cheered when a goal went in, and I completely went nuts on them, told them all to get out. And even to this day, my eldest son, he says, there was something in your eyes then, Dad. There was really something in your eyes. And I swore at them, told them all to get out, and kicked them out of my flat.
Wow.
And then at that point, I fell to my knees, punched a hole in the wall, and just left my flat and went out into the February night and, just seeking confrontation. I was nuts. I was completely nuts.
But obviously you did get over it eventually. You seem quite controlled now.
Ah, yeah. Well, now, I mean, it's been a number of years since all of this happened. It took me about 3 months to completely get over it for the zaps to stop. Mm-hmm. But I did find ways to control the zaps. And it may be beneficial to any of your listeners who are on Paxil or going through withdrawal. I basically used to soak a bath towel in the tub and then sort of like wring it out and then wrap it around my head like a turban. Okay. And that would kind of help with the zaps. I'd also run cold water under my wrists. That would also help. And then I'd also go for walks, but in the cold. I don't think I could have done this if it was the summer months.
Right.
Because there's just something about the heat and Paxil that just doesn't mix, and I can't put my finger on it. But for some reason, I always think if anybody's going to try and come off these drugs, even though there is no scientific literature on this, I think that they should try in the colder months rather than the hot months.
That's an interesting point. I was going to ask you if exercise would help, because
exercise raises serotonin levels anyway, with me, I put on a lot of weight when I was on Soroxa. I went up to about 19 stone. I know you guys don't use stone over there.
You have to multiply by 14, right?
Well, I'll leave that with you because I'm useless at maths. But I pretty much went up to, 19 stone. And once I sort of like came off it and was able to go out and start walking, I wouldn't walk during the day. That's the thing. I would walk when nobody could see me. And because I was just walking and walking and walking nonstop, because I had this anger in me, and you're trying to get this anger out, so you're just walking and walking and walking, the weight would soon fall off. And then, of course, later on, after the 3 months, I got myself a dog and was walking every day, regularly every day. And then the weight, of course, just piled up
For our American listeners, 19 stone is 266 pounds, which is pretty big.
Yep, there you go.
Although I'm almost that weight, but I'm also 6'3", so I guess.
I'm around about 15 stone, so I'd put on 4 stone. During that time, that's a lot.
That's about 60 pounds. That is a lot. So there's a saying, don't get mad, get even. And you'd had a lot of experiences getting mad while you were on the drugs. But once you got off, you didn't just kind of say, okay, that was a really bad trip. Let's get on with my life. You started to fight back against.
I did.
So what have you done since you got off, and you have a blog, and what's your purpose?
I do, Well, my blog is actually 10 years old on April this year, April the 6th this year. And I basically started researching Soroxa to see if other people was having this experience. And there really wasn't much back on Yahoo and Google back in, 10 years ago. And then I learned that Soroxat is actually called Paxil in the United States. So instead of Googling Soroxat, I'd started Googling Paxil.
Right.
And I hit gold.
Right.
Because there were so many people talking about the adverse reactions and the terrible side effects to Paxil. Right. And I remember reading an article by Evelyn Pringle. She's an investigative journalist. And I read this article and I thought, wow, I've got to do something like that. I need to start writing for the British people. And that's basically what I did. I started liaising with the British drug regulator, the equivalent to the FDA out there. They're called the MHRA. Mm-hmm. And the answers that I was getting off them was pretty vague. They were kind of just throwing these walls up at me. So because I wasn't getting the answers from them, I decided to kind of do a number on them. So I'd ridicule them online. I would publish everything that they sent me, the emails and stuff. And then I'd just use sarcasm. And that kind of became the Fiderman way, if you like. Now, when I write, there's always an element of a touch of humor in there, because this is a pretty dark subject, right? So there's always a touch of humor in my blogs. And then, of course, GlaxoSmithKline at one point, they took umbrage to a video that I created about their head of psychiatry, because this guy had been on BBC television and he'd been playing down the withdrawal and playing down the fact that this drug is harmful to children, which we all know it we all know it is now. Right. But at the time, he was playing it down. So I sort of like created this slideshow video, and I used one of GSK's songs that they use at their seminars for their reps, their drug reps. And they wrote to me and they basically told me to take it down, and, you know, I could get sued, this, that and the other. And I was advised to take it down, which I actually did, but I kept a raw copy and sent it to an American friend of mine who then re-uploaded it, and it had more hits than ever.
Yes.
And since then, GlaxoSmithKline, although they monitor my blog, because I know they do, I've got a device which tells me who's going on there, they don't really correspond with me anymore. You know, I still write to them, but I don't write about the current Sir Upset litigation. That would be wrong. I write and ask questions, knowing damn well that they're not going to answer me. It's just a thing of mine, you know?
Right, right. So tell us about this lawsuit.
Well, the lawsuit was filed almost 10 years ago, and it basically is a bunch of people that had difficulty getting off this drug, and we're claiming that, you know, we wasn't told about this at the time, because at the time when we was prescribed the drug and taking it, there was no mention of the severe withdrawal effects on the inserts, the patient information leaflet. Mm-hmm. And so basically that's why we're suing them, and hey, why not? Because, you know, you Americans have done it and they're a British company after all. So, you know, we should be allowed that right too. And it was only recently that we've been given the green light by the judge in charge. Glaxo had tried to put a halt to the trial, saying that we didn't have enough money to run it, and there was, you know, our witnesses.
Really?
We wanted to change
out.
Oh, yeah,
that's
for
a
sure.
good reason to deny you justice, because you don't have enough money. That's kind of ironic.
Well, see, the thing is with corporations and GlaxoSmithKline, if they learn that the other side is a small bunch of attorneys, what they will try to do, they will drag the case out for years.
Yeah.
And then right at the end of it, you know, they will come up with this. They haven't got enough money to run it. Truth of the matter is, we have got enough money to run the case. And we've got more where that came from, too.
Yeah.
So they can't go down that road now, you know, and the judge has pretty much told them that, you know. I think the judge knows what they're up to. He's pretty much told them that. So we're set to go to trial in the UK, which for us is all we ever wanted. We want to see the documents and the emails where GlaxoSmithKline have admitted internally that there's a problem with this drug. We want to see them. And not only that, we want doctors to see them, because for years, when you do struggle on this drug and other SSRIs, people don't actually believe you. They think you're sort of like making it up. It can't be that bad, you know, a small little pill. Well, let me tell you, it is really, really bad. And for years, Glaxo have kept quiet about it. And now, for the first time in England anyway, these documents are going to surface at trial.
And so what happens when GlaxoSmithKline comes to you with a big pile of money in one hand and a non-disclosure agreement in the other hand?
Well, again, that is because we're just claimants in this. That is down to our attorneys, you know. So if it gets to that stage, it is not at that stage. They have never made any offer. If it gets to that stage, then I'm sure our attorneys will approach us and say, hey, they have offered this, that and the other. But for a lot of us, we actually want to go to trial. We want to see these documents out there, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if there was a settlement which included, you know, an admission of the problems, better education. I mean, I can see a settlement being a beneficial thing, but normally the purpose of a settlement is they're paying you off to shut up and go away.
That's how litigation works. And litigation is not about justice.
No.
It's about money. Now, you know, if these were criminal charges, maybe that would be different. And, you know, with criminal charges, you're not really going to get a bunch of attorneys, be it in Britain or America, take on a pharmaceutical company because they want to put their CEO behind bars. Because really, nothing in it for him. There's no financial gain for the attorneys, you know. Now, GSK have been involved in so many cases and have paid out billions of dollars in America and recently China. And they're also embroiled in fraud in various other countries as well. In fact, I've just recently stumbled on something, which is normally what happens with me. I go on a trail, you know, I'll read a story, go on a trail. And I've recently learned that in Nigeria, which was reported, they was running a promotion for their soft drink, Ribena, and Lucozade, the sports drink.
Right.
And three of their employees have just been arraigned in Nigeria for basically it was a fake promotion that they were running. Now, I don't know the ins and outs of it because it's like trying to get blood out of a stone when you're looking for stuff in Nigeria.
So what do you mean,
you know?
It was a fake promotional scam? Like,
well, it was a fake lotto. Now, I don't know whether or not the winners that was chosen was actually not real winners. They were just paid a percentage of the real money. I don't know that. I can't get to the bottom of it, but I have got somebody that knows the Nigerian media working on it for me. But that's the small story. That's the story that was reported. Now, one of these employees is actually GlaxoSmithKline's legal counsel in Nigeria. He's one of the named three. So me being a blogger and me having this fetish for investigating GlaxoSmithKline, I started investigating this one guy, and I learned that his previous job was at the Gulf Bank of Nigeria, where he was arraigned on a 21 count of fraud, embezzling money and stuff like that.
You think that would disqualify him to work in
at GlaxoSmithKline? Absolutely. But here's the rub. I cannot find the outcome of that case. Now, I've been on the Nigerian judicial website. It's not on there. The story just seems to end. Now, fairly recently, somebody on Twitter got in touch with me and they said, have you heard about the judge who arraigned these people in the Gulf Bank of Nigeria trial? And I said, no. And they said, well, he's recently been fingered in a bribery scandal. Now, has this guy been bribed, this judge in Nigeria? I do not know. I just cannot find the outcome of this trial. I've actually emailed GlaxoSmithKline Nigeria and I've said, what was the outcome of the trial and why is this guy working for you when he's got a previous record of alleged fraud? We're talking millions of Nigerian, I think it's called Naira, their currency. Right. Millions of Nigerian Naira. So at my blog, as I said earlier, you know, I can monitor who's going on there or at least what countries are going on there. It's been getting a massive amount of interest from Nigeria lately, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a lot of these countries, the media can be suppressed. I mean, I often say that if I want to know what's going on in the United States, I follow Russia Today or Al Jazeera or something.
And yeah,
if I want to know what's going on in Russia, like Russia Today is the last place I'd go.
Well, you're absolutely correct. In fact, you know, part of my research, it led me to this paper that was published online, and it was just about the corruption in Nigeria, particularly within the media. You know, if there's a hot news story, they will tend not to run with it if it involves a big corporate company. Yeah. And it's not through fear of being sued. It's through fear of losing revenue, you know, advertisements and such, you know.
Well, I think us as consumers bear a lot of responsibility for preferring a media system that's based on advertising. Nobody wants to pay Facebook money, so where does Facebook get their money from? From advertising.
Mm-hmm.
We complain about it, but nobody's turning around and saying, gee, Facebook, if I paid you $10 a year, you would actually make more money, and we would be your customers. Because right now, you're not the customer of Facebook or Twitter or whoever. It's the advertisers.
Yes. Yeah.
And so they have a big incentive to keep the advertisers happy. Of course, they pretend they're all for freedom of speech, but when it really gets tight, they're going to side with the money.
Yeah.
One other thing that you said, there's a few things that you said that on your blog that interested me. One of them was a cigarette patch with an antidepressant in it. Can you describe that?
I'm sorry, a cigarette patch with an antidepressant?
Yeah, you said there was Wellbutrin inside a cigarette patch.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, the antidepressant Wellbutrin, what GSK actually did, when that drug first came to market, Wellbutrin, they were getting a lot of feedback, GSK. People on it would go to their doctor, you know, I don't know how many, but they would say things like, you know what, doc, I don't feel like smoking anymore. So, you know, cue the dollar signs in the eyes of all the GSK executives. And they thought, well, maybe we can promote this antidepressant for a smoking cessation drug. Well, of course they couldn't. So instead, what they did, they took it back into the lab, changed a molecule here and there, and rebadged it as Zyban, a smoking cessation drug.
Okay, so the reason they didn't want to tell people, take this antidepressant to quit smoking, is because people would say, that doesn't make any sense.
And well,
if they had exactly the same molecule, then people would say there's an antidepressant in it. But if they changed a few molecules, they could say, oh, no, it's not an antidepressant. It's a smoking cessation drug.
Yeah, that's all that you need to do is just change the molecule here and there. But the trouble that they faced with Zyban is if somebody went to the doctors and they was on Wellbutrin, let's say, for depression, they would, and the Wellbutrin wasn't making them stop smoking, you know, they've not heard of this thing, they would say to their doctor, is there anything that can help me stop smoking? And the doctor would say, oh, sure, there's a new drug on the market called Zyban. And he would prescribe them Zyban, so in effect, he was just doubling the dose of Wellbutrin.
Right, and this was a patch or a drug that you took for
this? This is a pill. It's a pill.
Oh, it's a pill. Okay, I thought it was
yeah. In fact, my sister, I remember my sister when I was a good few years ago now, you know, she pretty much knows what I do. And she rang me up, she goes, Bob, I've just been to the doctor's and he's prescribed me Zyban to stop smoking. And I said to her, this is over the telephone. I said, do me a favor. Even though it says Zyban on the carton, on the box, open it up for me and pull the blister pack out. And she did. And I said, what does it say on the blister pack? And she says, Wellbutrin.
Wow.
Yeah. That actually interested. A couple of years ago, I won a human rights award from CCHR, and the guys came out to England to interview me. And because my place was too small, they held the interview at my sister's place. You know, they had to set up cameras and whatnot. And it really interested one of the guys there, so much so that he spent about half an hour filming this box from different angles, you know.
Yeah.
But it is, it's just pretty amazing what they can get away with, you know.
Well, they love to talk about their innovation, but 99% of being a drug company is imitating the competition, recycling one of your drugs that's going off patent, changing a molecule, like you say, here or there, and then you come up with something that's slightly different. It's another antidepressant, or now it's smoking cessation, or I think there was an antidepressant that I think was supposed to help with like premenstrual symptoms or something, and they changed the color of the pill to a nice light purple.
Yeah. And it was Prozac. Yeah, it was Prozac, yeah, basically. Yeah. But they've done the same with Paxil. There's a drug out at the moment called Brizdal, and it pretty much it's for you know, premenstrual tension and stuff like that. And when you look carefully, it's actually 7.5 milligrams of paroxetine. Paroxetine is Paxil.
Right.
So what you're doing, you're giving, you know, women this drug who have got, you know, the built up tension and whatnot. You're just adding fuel to the fire by giving them this. And they don't know that they're taking Paxil because, as you say, it's in a bright pink box with, you know, the brand name Brizdal, which is so far removed from Paxil and what it actually is.
And speaking of women, you've also talked about birth defects and some antidepressants. Is this a problem with all antidepressants or just with Paxil? Or?
Pretty much so, no. I mean, you've got Lexapro and Citalopram, which is Celexa in the States. there's many, many stories out there and many, many cases actually that have been settled. There was one woman who contacted me after she lost her case against GlaxoSmithKline birth defects. She also lost the appeal and she stumbled on my blog and we started talking. And because I'm pretty much clued up on everything that GSK get up to, what she was telling me, it rang some bells. So I asked her to watch a video deposition, which I managed to get my hands on and uploaded it to YouTube. And I said, I want you to watch this and get back to me. So she started watching it. Within about 15 minutes, she emailed me back and she says, that woman who's being depositioned, who was a woman from GlaxoSmithKline, is actually talking about me. And I said, I thought as much. Now, with the evidence that I then got, I got in touch with her solicitors and I said, look, you've missed out on a trick here, because this woman was mentioned in an internal email from GlaxoSmithKline in a previous birth defect case. And Glaxo actually admitted that the reason she had to abort her child was probably down to the Paxil that she was taking. Now, with that information, her lawyers got back in touch with GSK and an out-of-court settlement was made.
Wow.
But I've not seen or heard of this woman again. I spent about 3 months working on that case for her.
Yeah.
And I've not seen or heard from her again. So, you know, good luck to her. You know, she got some compensation.
I mean, it's kind of sad in a way, because it's people like you who really make the difference, the people who persist year after year, uphill battle. And yet, you know, with this court case, maybe you're going to end up making a big difference. Because if the word gets out, then that's basically one drug that gets taken off the market. I mean, the problem is there's a barrage of look-alike drugs. And if they take Paxil off the market, you know, what are they going to do? Put something else on?
Well, Paxil is rarely prescribed now in the UK because of the bad press that it's had over here.
Right.
We have a flagship current affairs program on the BBC called Panorama.
Mm-hmm.
They have done four shows on Paxil. That's unheard of. They've done four shows, and because of that, a lot of people have been educated about
right.
this drug. Oh my God, it's really bad. But the thing is also with Paxil, it's not just GSK these days that sell Paxil, because they lost the patent, and other drug firms, you know, will sell Paxil.
Generic.
Generic versions, which kind of leads me nicely to the Wendy Doling case, the suicide case currently going on in America. Wendy Doling, her husband, he killed himself just 6 days after being prescribed Paxil.
Mm-hmm.
He'd basically gone for a business lunch and then went downtown to Chicago and jumped off the platform in front of a train.
Wow.
Now, this isn't unheard of, because there was a previous Paxil case back in the early 2000s or maybe late 1990s, where a guy had killed his family members, then turned the gun on himself. Well, a jury actually found GlaxoSmithKline's Paxil 80% for the cause of that happening, 80%, and 20% was down to the guy that actually shot his family members.
Right.
And Glaxo was fined, I think it was something like $7.5 million. So that's $7.5 million for killing a family and then yourself, you know. Anyway, in the case of Wendy Doling, it's quite remarkable when you look at her case, what GSK's lawyers are doing to this woman. Basically, it's just what I spoke about earlier. You will either run a case into the ground because the other side have got less money than you, or you will try and target the person bringing the suit against you. And it certainly looks like that's what they're doing with Wendy Doling, because she's got a great law firm behind her in Baum Hedlund. They're out in Los Angeles.
Right.
And, of course, you know, Glaxo can't really run them into the ground, because, you know, they're going to have lots of money to run these cases because they've ran them before, you know, and been hugely successful, particularly against GlaxoSmithKline. But what the King and Spalding, Glaxo's lawyers, have done with Wendy in this case, they've brought up her her love life. They've subpoenaed cell phone records. They've showed her children their dead father's medical records. They have done everything. They've tried to get expert witnesses for Wendy removed from being expert witnesses, and they have failed miserably in all of their motions. The judge has denied them every single motion. So again, that case is going to trial. They have tried everything to get it stopped, and it's going to trial. Now, more than likely, will that case be settled, such as the British Soroxat withdrawal cases? There's a good chance that they may be settled, because GSK do not want these documents coming out and being made public.
It's not the money.
They don't want it.
It's not the money that they're going to pay to her. I mean, she may make less money if she persists with the court case, but it's the bad publicity.
Absolutely. You know, how much bad can it get for GSK? I mean, they are constantly in the news for bad things. And they deny all the, you know, fraud in China, the $3 billion lawsuit against the Department of Justice, you know. They were fined $3 billion. That's a phenomenal amount of money. And then they promised to be good. And then they come out and say, we are the only we were the first pharmaceutical company to open our doors and to be transparent. And yet since then, it's been learned that they're not. They're still committing fraud in China, you know, and other countries. And, you know, we get, as a blogger, you know, I get many people contacting me saying that, you know, they want to be a whistleblower. You know, they work within GSK. But I actually get that information from another blogger called The Truth Man. He's a great blogger. Also goes up against GSK. He's got a great blog called GSK License to Kill. It is a fantastic blog. Now, we've been pretty much doing this for about 10 years now, myself and this blogger. And we have, when you Google Soroxat now in the UK, when I first started all those years ago, like I told you at the head of the show, I couldn't really find much. But now you Google Soroxat and pretty much our blogs come up, you know, which is a great achievement.
Yes. Well, I think education of the general population is the big thing, because if people don't see the doctors as the solution to their problems, if they're sad, they find other ways to solve it. I mean, whether it's going for a walk or going to church or whatever, there's a lot of other ways to deal with these issues. And in the long run, I'm really not convinced that, except in like really serious crises, that there is much that drugs can do. We sort of come towards the end of our time. So is there anything you'd like to wrap up that you really wanted to get off your chest that we haven't got to yet?
You'd never be allowed to go on air again if you allowed me to.
Okay, that's bad idea. Okay, yeah, are there some calm, rational? No. Are there anything you have to say to kind of wrap up our discussion?
Yeah, all I'd like to say is, if you are on Paxil and you are thinking about coming off it, don't just stop taking it. It takes a long time for some people. It takes a long time to get off this drug, and you have to taper very, very, very slowly. Do not listen or do not believe in what the patient information leaflet says. It's a bunch of bunkum. Do your research on the drug, and if at all you need any help on trying to get off Paxil, drop me a line. My email address is on my blog, fidemanblogspot.com.
Okay, and I'll include a link to the blog in the show notes. Thank you so much for joining me.
Fantastic.
Today, Bob.
No
really
problem.
Appreciate it.
No problem.
Okay, goodbye then.
Goodbye.
Here's some short takes from this week's news. Associated Press tweets, Breaking, French experts, German Wings pilot was using antidepressants when he crashed jet into the Alps. And then Twitter goes nuts. Was it all pharma trolls? Or have people really not heard that antidepressants can cause suicidal behavior? Now that AIDS is back in the news because of the reported shunning of Rock Hudson after he was diagnosed with AIDS by Nancy Reagan, and other people saying you shouldn't say nasty things about the dead, there's an article written a year or two ago by Elizabeth Ely and Cal Curley, which I'll provide a link to. The article documents his use of the inhalant drug poppers, nitrite inhalants, which was very common in the gay community, and also that Rock Hudson was suffering from liver cancer at the time of his diagnosis with AIDS. The left, the so-called progressives, are saying that the right didn't care about gay men, which is probably largely true. But nobody is saying that all the progressives did was kill gay men with toxic AIDS drugs, and nobody wants to address the drug abuse that was rampant in the so-called fast-track gay lifestyle, just as drug abuse is rampant in many heterosexual subsets of society with consequent health problems. From Switzerland, listener Sascher wrote, I'm a frequent listener and appreciate your show very much. I haven't found any news in English about the Stefan Lanka legal case on the measles virus. I was wondering whether you'd heard about the decision of a German court that there was no scientific publication proving the existence of the virus. To back up, Stefan Lanka is a virologist and one of the early critics of the AIDS-HIV dogma. In 2011, he offered a €100,000 award for anyone who presented a scientific publication proving the existence of the measles virus and determining its diameter. A doctor, David Barden, presented 6 publications, claimed the reward, and sued Lanka for refusing to pay. A first ruling demanded that Lanka must indeed pay, but on February 16, 2016, a court in Stuttgart decided on appeal that the proof for the existence of the measles virus had not been completed. And she provides a little bit of a translation from Hans Tolson of Vaccine Report. Biologist Stefan Lanka does not have to pay a €100,000 award to the Saxony-based Dr. David Bardens after all. Bardens had tried to prove the existence of the measles virus by submitting 6 publications. Lanka had offered the award for anyone who presented a publication in which the virus was proven to exist and in which the diameter was determined. The District Court of Stuttgart ruled that the demanded proof was not presented, for the required single publication could not be presented. So this seems like kind of a technical decision, but Sascher continues, the Speaker of the Court went so far as to warn journalists to be very careful with their headlines, for the verdict does not deny the existence of the virus, nor does it confirm it. They insist it is only about the wording of the single publication instead of the 6 that were presented by Bardens. The court omitted the fact that the reviewers had said that not one of the publications proves the existence of the virus. The fact that 6 publications were presented, it was then left open for interpretation that all 6 combined would have proved the case, but they never actually said that. Thank you, Sascher, for providing information on a story that indeed has not been reported in the English-speaking world. Thank you for listening to episode 93 of The Infectious Myth. If you've got a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Go to facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.